The Catholics of Oz is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to episode 28 of The Catholics of Oz. The Catholics of Oz is a show where we discuss faith, culture, and what's been happening from an Aussie perspective. Whether it's synods or science, apostolates and apps, providence or productivity, you can hear it right now on The Catholics of Oz. Hello and welcome to episode 28 of The Catholics of Oz. We're very happy for you to join us. In today's episode, I am joined by, we'll start with my sister Caroline. Caroline, how are you going?
I'm great, Lindsay. How are you doing?
I'm going really well. And Jerry, how are you?
Hey guys, good to be here.
Cool. It's good to have everyone on board as always. So we've got a couple of topics to discuss today. But before we do that, I'd like to remind everyone, please, to remember to like The Catholics of Oz on the SQPN Facebook page when episodes of ours are listed there. Don't forget to retweet our episodes on Twitter and to leave us comments. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, your favorite podcast app. And also SQPN has a channel on YouTube. And all of our episodes are posted there as well. Just hit the bell to get notifications when new episodes come out. Don't forget also to leave comments on your favorite podcast directories because that helps other people to find our show. And we're always happy to have new people jumping on board. So let's begin with our first segment, Faith Beyond Borders.
Well, I'm actually feeling rather good about this. I think we've all arrived at a very special place, eh? Oh. Spiritually, ecumenically.
How do you make somebody love you without affecting free will?
Welcome to my world, son. You come up with an answer to that one, you let me know.
Yes, I had to work very hard to pass Latin and theology.
Oh, quite. Those are, of course, the most important things.
Oh, yeah.
I'd sit this one out, Cap.
I don't see how I can.
These guys come from legend. They're basically gods.
There's only one god, man. And I'm pretty sure he doesn't dress like that.
So, for this topic, we've got a couple of things to talk about today, but we thought we'd go to a story that we've heard before, but one that we love. I know that one that Jared loves as well a lot. And then, Jared, I'm actually going to get you to take the lead on this today. So, we wanted to, as a Faith Beyond Borders topic, because in a way it has a lot of Faith Beyond Borders implications to it. And I know that the three of us... maybe not ourselves, but our children are connoisseurs and frequent visitors of a certain restaurant with golden arches known as McDonald's. And so we love this story. So, Jared, can you please tell us about the Catholic origin of the fillet of fish burger?
All right. So first up, fillet of fish in Australia, fillet of fish perhaps in other countries.
Yeah, good to clarify that.
Yeah. Now, obviously, this is a favourite Lenten story of ours because we spend a lot of time relatively at that restaurant compared to others. But Lent poses a different problem if we were to, say, visit on a Friday or perhaps even Ash Wednesday or even Good Friday if we were that poor on places to go. So the origin of the filet of fish burger, so it was originally called the fish that catches people. So in 1962, there was a Catholic businessman, Lou Groen. He was a McDonald's franchisee owner. And so he lived in, I think, Cincinnati, Ohio, in a rather Catholic neighborhood. And so during Lent, he would notice that sales of, his sales, essentially, while McDonald's was a meat-only burger place, would suffer during Fridays in Lent. Actually, no, looking at this, Catholics didn't eat meat on Fridays all year round.
Oh, so, all year round. Okay, now that I didn't know. Okay.
Yeah, so we used to Lent on Fridays, no meat. And so looking at this article here, all year round was the go back then. So he basically had a restaurant that operated 6 days of the week, and the seventh day was filled with non-Catholics, I guess. And probably as well. Oh, I'll get to that bit later. So McDonald's only serves meat, so what is he going to do on a Friday in his largely Catholic neighborhood? Well, what's the alternative to meat? I suppose would be fish. So he got to work on a solution, created a batter, tartar sauce, and made what he called a new kind of fish sandwich. Now, he was in a bit of a pickle because franchisee. He can't just choose what to sell at his restaurant. So he took it to the McDonald's CEO at the time, Ray Kroc.
Oh, I thought it was Ronald McDonald. Okay, you got me there.
I thought
he's always been the CEO. Yeah, sorry, keep going.
So Ray had, I think, taken over from the McDonald's brothers at the time. So McDonald's started, I think, in the 40s, and then Ray Kroc took it over sometime after the Second World War.
Right.
So Ray was also in the same sort of idea in that he needed a burger that didn't have meat in it. And so he wasn't sold on Lou's idea of a fish burger. So what happened was, I guess, a competition in a way. Lou's burger, the filet of fish, I think was ended up being branded. I don't know if it was that at the time though. Went up against Ray's version of a meatless burger, which was a pineapple inside a cold bun.
Mm.
Yum! Wish they'd started that instead.
Call the Hula Burger.
The Hula Burger.
So the Hula Burger went up against the Filet-O-Fish on a Lenten Friday. I don't know which location it was. And the idea was whichever burger sold more, that would be added to the national menu. So in 1962, they went head-to-head. And obviously we know the outcome because what's in our restaurants these days. Lou sold 350 Filet-O-Fishes, and it's a little hard to get this number because apparently he sold only 6 Hula Burgers.
Oh, okay. it's a bit less.
So it's a little hard to pinpoint that because you can imagine him not being too proud of that number. But clearly, Lou won the bet by a fair way, and so that was the start of a non-meat option being added to the McDonald's menu.
Right. So do we know if the pineapple was deep fried or anything, or was it just a slab of pineapple in between two buns? Is there any news on that or info?
Canned pineapple.
So the only info I've got is that it's like a normal burger but has a slice of pineapple instead of meat.
Right. It just sounds awful.
See, if it was deep fried, you could almost get there, put a slice of cheese, almost.
I imagine it would have been cooked to, meat's cooked, so it's supposed to be replaced the meat.
Yeah.
But
still,
pineapple is like an add-on or a garnish.
Topping. Yeah. It's like people who don't like pineapple on pizza. I mean, and bless you if you don't, that some of us actually do, but yeah.
I used to not, but now I do, which is weird.
Yeah, it's kind of grown on me as well, yeah. But yeah. I don't think the Hula Burger will ever grow on me.
No.
No.
Yeah, need so a bit of bacon. Ever since then, after the landslide victory by the Filet-O-Fish, it ended up on menus. I think it started approaching the national menu, and I think it full on all the menus. Here it is, nationwide status in 1965.
I just love McDonald's Filet-O-Fish sandwiches.
Golden brown, plump, moist, and flaky, topped with our own tangy tartar sauce. McDonald's Filet-O-Fish sandwich.
Let the fish that catches people catch you.
Look for the golden arches where quality starts fresh every day.
And so it's had its ups and downs. They tried to replace it, I think, in the mid-90s with their deluxe range, which fell very flat.
Mm.
And then with being sourcing fish, McDonald's appears to be trying to do the ethical thing and try and, what is that? What do they call that stuff? Sustainable fishing.
Good
so
move.
With the amount of filet of fish that get eaten during the year, they sometimes have trouble being able to catch that much fish in one spot without fishing the place out.
Yeah, that's a good move to go sustainable as well. Yeah, we are. I mean, you can't sustainably source pineapple, I guess. That's fish was a good move anyway. Yeah.
Isn't there enough in Queensland?
I suppose the byproduct of that is we've got a oversupply of pineapple now because no one's buying the Hula Burgers.
<Yes. laughs> No, there's all that pizza that they put it on now.
Yeah,
that's how it ended up on pizza. You don't like it on pizza, blame Ray's Hula Burger.
That's the story of how pineapple ended up on pizza.
Yeah, we'll call that an apocryphal story. But
so
sure,
the story has a pretty good ending for Lou as well. So he was struggling at the time, obviously without being able to fully furnish his restaurant, especially on Fridays. But he said this has saved his franchise, and his operation grew massively. I think at his peak, he had 43 McDonald's restaurants spread over America, and certainly had a good ending with that. Based on the humble Filet-O-Fish, he puts it down to.
All it took was the Catholic observance of not eating meat on Fridays to make this man rich. And Catholics of the world rejoice because all of us get to enjoy it now as well.
Because we get to have a burger on Fridays.
Yeah. Caroline, I know you said this before the show, but why don't you tell us how you like your fillet of fish burger?
I decided that, you know, because they only give you one bit of fish, like one fry. What do they call it? You're serving anyway, a portion. And so I've started buying the double fillet or double fillet of fish, as we call it here. And the good thing is, I think the first time I bought it, they put like the sauce, the tartar sauce, in between the two portions, and the burger kind of slipped down. But they've learnt now not to put anything in there. So they put sauce on the bottom of the bun and on the top, and then they close it down, and the, you know, it stays quite, you know, so you can eat it.
They've
doesn't
mastered
just slip
the art
out
of it now.
Yeah. They've got it. So, yeah. So, and both, I have to tell you something though, because on Ash Wednesday it was, Mum and I happened to be together, and we both wanted, we just thought we'd just get a McDonald's burger. And, you know, I go to Mum because I thought she'd be like, no, you've got today, you know, it's fasting. You've got to eat really small, you know, you've got to. And I'm like, Mum, I think I'm going to get the double fillet of fish. And I thought I'd be told off. She's like, you know what? I'm going to get the double as well and make it a medium meal. I'm like, she's like, I'm really hungry.
That's great.
So, yeah, there we go. That's a little secret.
Mum being the most observant Catholic we know as well.
She really is. She's the one that, you know, is constantly reminding, oh, I found this prayer, I found this talk, I found this, I found
that's
that.
Right. Yeah.
She loves the double fillet of fish.
Yeah.
Yes.
Jerry, is there anything else to add to this story? Because I've got another direction to take this topic before.
Sure. Just one final quote from Lou Groen, who invented, when he took the Filet-O-Fish to the CEO, Ray, Ray's response at first was, you're always coming up here with a bunch of crap. I don't want my store stuck up with the smell of fish.
That's great. That'll never work.
But I feel like in terms of, you know, how pungent a burger or an item can be, I feel like the Filet-O-Fish is probably one of the least.
Yeah, I agree.
It's not bad.
Like some of the, especially the breakfast items can get a bit, you know. I remember going to school, you know, almost 20 years ago now, and the way to school was on the train, then you go to a bus stop, catch a bus to the drop-off outside school, and the stopover was right near a McDonald's. This is at a time where McDonald's only served breakfast at breakfast time and not throughout the rest of the day.
All day breakfast,
so people
yeah.
would come on the bus with their egg and bacon McMuffins and everything else, and boy, the rest of the, if they were at the other end of the bus, you could still smell it. If you're up the back, you could smell someone who was sitting in the front seat eating their burger. That was a strong smell. So I'd like to be able to say to Ray, you wouldn't have to worry about the smell of this Filet-O-Fish.
Yeah, they should have just bought Filet-O-Fish burgers. Yeah. So just to take this in another direction then, so there's another article that I added to our notes for this. So from the Diocese of Philadelphia, because there's been a discussion.
Philadelphia?
Funny. Yes. I'm sure that's not how they say it. But there was a discussion about whether or not I think they're called impossible burgers or impossible meat, but basically the idea of these meat substitute kind of burgers, which are made of things like soy and potato and whatever else. So in the article I was reading that these burgers, they try to replicate the texture, the taste, you know, the look of meat so much that they even bleed while you cook them. So that's the so they're really, really going for this, you know, you're eating meat, not meat kind of thing. So there was a discussion, and in this article that I've got here, you know, I think it was the bishop or from the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, they were saying, you know, maybe eating this on Friday as an alternative to meat is not really like representing a sacrifice anymore, because all you're doing is replacing actual meat with something that looks, tastes, you know, simulates, acts like meat when you cook it and things like that. So the question I want to throw out to you guys, let's just get some opinions going here. Do you think it's okay to go for impossible meat or impossible burgers in order to replace meat on Fridays in Lent? What do you think, Caroline?
I guess I take both sides, really. Like, if it's not actually meat, it's okay. But the thing is, I don't know what it tastes like. Like, is it really good? Like, is it that good that you'd want to eat it? Like, you know, because if it's just gross, you probably wouldn't want to eat it anyway. And the other side of things is, I guess, if my opinion is that if it really is resembling meat and you're getting the same experience as eating meat, then probably you're kind of defeating the purpose and just don't have it because, you know, you're not supposed to have meat when we're not supposed to have meat. Although I just remembered McDonald's does have this McVeggie burger now, doesn't it? It's like I've tried one and it's just like the patty's just like mashed potato almost. And
yes.
They don't put any tomato sauce in it, so I always order the tomato sauce just to because it doesn't – and a bit of bacon won't go astray either. But anyway, that's a side note. So, yeah,
I guess – that goes besides the point.
I know. So really, it's not my favorite. But anyway, yeah, so I guess the two answers I have is if it's not meat, it's probably okay. But if you're getting the experience of meat, then maybe try another burger with a fillet of fish. Yeah. Yeah,
sure. Jerry, what are your thoughts?
Probably similar to Caroline's in that you sort of fall both sides of the fence, but potentially for different reasons. First of all, I have had a so-called impossible burger. And when you mentioned they try and replicate tastes, let me just say they've got a little bit of a way to go, or at least they did in the burger that I had. So in terms of giving up meat and having a sacrifice and it being a sacrifice, I really feel like I sacrificed something when I had that burger.
So go ahead.
Yeah. So I wasn't knock yourself out because of Lent. It was just let's see what this is like. Let's give it a go because you're never going to know what something tastes like, looks like, smells like, whatever. If you don't give it a go. And maybe have to give it more than one go because I've given it one go and it was terrible, but then I hear other people giving it reasonable or decent reviews. So I'm probably not going to try this impossible meat on a Friday or on Ash Wednesday, well, past Ash Wednesday now, because while it might not be meat and it might still be a sacrifice to eat it, it's still taking the form of meat. It's meant to be a meat replacement. And I think for us as Catholics, we're supposed to be trying to give up meat, not trying to find or cheat our way around not giving up meat. Now, I think I mentioned it last year when we were talking about Lent. I've learned my lesson in terms of cheating on Lent.
Mm-hmm.
When you give up Nando's, you give up the Nando sauce as well.
That's right. Of course, yeah.
You don't cheat by not going to the restaurant, but just having the sauce that's associated with the restaurant. It's cheating.
Oh, that's
so
good.
Yes, we do like our shortcuts and our ways around things, but I feel like Impossible Burger, having an Impossible Burger in place of meat is trying to, you know, take a shortcut.
Yeah, actually, Jerry, I feel like you're an authority.
You're kind of losing the spirit of what they're doing there.
Yeah, I feel like you're the authority on not taking Lent shortcuts, considering your previous experience. Yeah. I was looking at the article and some things that were said. And I think the key thing is because there was a person, Todd Williamson, he's the director of the Office of Divine Worship in the Archdiocese of Chicago. And he told the Chicago Tribune, basically, the thing is you risk losing the whole spirit of Lent if you're just trying to substitute things that you're sacrificing with something else. So for example, and again, I'm not criticizing people for, you know, for whatever decisions they make, they know why they make them. But, you know, sometimes people try and go for fancy ways of eating fish on, like, for example, let's talk about this. Last year we talked about the, Perfect for Lent, remember in Woolworths?
Yeah.
So being one of our large, retail chains here, or grocery chains, I should say. So they have another Perfect for Lent advertising. I think they just got the same banners on last year and paste them on their website.
I think they think we eat fish every day, though, the way they do it.
Yeah, the way they're going. Yeah, but did you see all these exorbitant and fancy-looking fish meals
lobsters
that they've got? You know,
and
yeah,
prawns
lobster with this,
and scallops,
and all this,
beautiful salmon, and
As if Catholics, you know, spend lots and lots of money just so they can eat really expensive fish on Fridays. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think
I'm starting to wonder. Sorry to interrupt. I'm starting to wonder whether giving up fish, having fish on Fridays is actually a reasonable thing to give up anymore, since it's starting to become a bit of a delicacy.
Yeah,
it's true.
And this is the key thing, really. Let's remember the spirit of why we're doing things. So Now, I'm not going to tell people how to eat fish or how to eat meat or not meat on Fridays in Lent or on Good Friday. Yes. But I guess the key thing is let's remember why we're doing it in the first place. And I think there are two things to think about. So I'll reference this article that I've got here that will be in our show notes. Alison Covey is the assistant professor of ethics at Villanova University. Now, it says here that she has a background in theology and has published works on ethical veganism. And she said the question of whether or not we eat impossible meat marks an exciting time if you're following a plant-based diet. She said it implies these products have risen to a level in which they no longer represent sacrifice. But then she referenced Pope Francis's 2015 homily on avoiding gluttony. And she said that if the faithful are attempting to truly show solidarity with the global poor during Lent, things like lentils and rice are more in the spirit than meat analogs. Still, eating a Beyond or Impossible burger on a Friday in Lent, she said, isn't the worst thing. So I think that's a pretty good summary.
It is, Jared.
Yeah, unless you're Jared and that, it totally is the worst thing. So I think at the end of the day, we just have to, with all these discussions, because technology will change food in all kinds of ways in the future, we just have to ask ourselves personally if our intention is an authentic sacrifice, because our sacrifice, of course, does show solidarity with the poor. That's one thing. But it also, by sacrificing, we create space for Jesus to enter our hearts more. You know, we're trying to open our lives up more to God. So if you are, you know, eating a nice big piece of fried fish, you know, or some caviar, or, you know, whatever, you know, some beautiful scallops or whatever. Has Jesus got any room? Yeah, but has Jesus got any room to come in, or, you know, are you not really making any space for him? Yeah.
Well, so, how about,
yep,
what if you had a fisherman's basket?
Yeah, that probably is worse, isn't it? That's like all the fried fish, like, isn't it? Like fried stuff all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a glutton's paradise.
What was
paradise.
Peter before he became the Pope?
That's true. But then Peter didn't have was it Good Fridays for a while, did he? There were no Fridays in Lent for him right away. Yeah. All right. Well, let's shift tack a little bit now. So we've talked about that, and we'd love to know what our listeners have to say about that too. Would you eat an impossible burger on Friday? On a Friday in Lent, and is a legitimate thing to do, or would you say no, not at all? It's against the spirit of things. But let's move on. We wanted to talk about coronavirus a little bit. So I won't set too much context, except to say that right now in Australia, at least, I think there are 60 cases, approximately 60 or a little bit more than that, at the time of recording. And so it's on a lot of people's minds around the world for a lot of reasons. There's lots of media reporting. You know, its rate of infection and so on, and Caroline will talk about that soon. So we're actually using this to lead into our science topic. So before we do our science topic, I wanted to set the context only by saying or by talking about what the Archdiocese of Melbourne and what most dioceses around Australia have done in terms of precautions about this. So I'll just go through the very, very short list of this. So Archbishop Peter Comensoli sent a letter on the 4th of March, and this is in follow-up to a letter that he sent on the 28th of February. So they're doing seven-day revisions of these precautions. So at the moment in Melbourne, the advice is Holy Communion is not to be given under both species anymore, like for now. Most parishes don't do that anyway, but the chalice is not to be shared at Mass. It's only for the celebrant, or it's got celebrants, so if you've got a couple of priests or a priest and a deacon. But basically, lay people are not to drink from the chalice, just the ministers. If there are extraordinary ministers of communion, they need to sanitize their hands before and after distributing Holy Communion. And it says here, it's always a good practice to supply tissues and get hand gels at church liturgies and gatherings, particularly for ministers of the Eucharist, along with bins for disposal of any used tissues. Now, during the Rite of Peace, it says here, there's no need to take special measures or suspend the Rite of Peace. However, if there are parishioners with coughs and sneezes, or if there are people who would class themselves as vulnerable, or any parishioners who just feel uncomfortable about shaking hands at the sign of peace, it says they may just want to exchange the peace of Christ with a smile or a bow, or simply just say, peace be with you, and should be encouraged to do so if that's what they want to do. And lastly, it just says, of course, please make sure that your congregations are aware of what's going on. So share these precautions with them. and also give them the federal government's guidelines about washing hands, keeping yourself safe during the coronavirus outbreak, etc. So with that, let's move into talking about science.
Ah, what a fine day for science.
You have any hobbies?
I collect spores, molds, and fungus.
Can you reverse the polarity?
I'll do my best.
So, Caroline, having those precautions that the Archdiocese of Melbourne has put into place in dioceses around Australia, and I'm assuming most dioceses around the world, tell us, what is coronavirus? What have you, you know, why should we be worried? Shouldn't we be worried? What's, from a science point of view, what's going on?
Okay, so I think we should have a healthy concern. I don't think we need to panic, but from what I've read, you probably don't want to catch this disease, especially if you're like vulnerable, if you're elderly or if you're a bit immune suppressed or something like that. So I think it's a really good advice to take the advice, and perhaps when you're in a large gathering, maybe to limit physical contact. So and I will let you know why now. So I thought I'd give you a little bit of a not too detailed scientific background about the coronavirus and some medical information as well about how the virus infects us and how it affects people medically. So actually, we say the coronavirus, but the truth is that there's actually a range of coronaviruses, okay? So it's actually a large family of viruses. We're talking about particularly the COVID-19 disease, which is caused by the SARS-CoV-2 virus, okay? So generally, coronaviruses can cause illnesses in animals, and it can be spread to people. And other coronaviruses already infect us in the form of like cold-like diseases. You know, like you get a common cold, it's a coronavirus. So there have been examples of coronaviruses before, and I'm pretty sure you guys have heard of them. So, for example, SARS. Remember SARS happened a few years ago in 2002, 2003. So this was the severe acute respiratory syndrome, which is actually what this one is now, and it's called number two, okay? So that one also spread from China to about 30 other countries. It caused about 900 deaths and infected about 8,400 people. And we'd never seen this happen before, that SARS virus. So they're thinking that it spread from animal to human. They're saying most likely from an animal called a civet. It's like a small cat-like animal. Okay. But they're thinking that one originated in a bat. So maybe the bat got the cat. Starter, right?
There's and a kid somehow, story in this, yeah.
Yeah, there's another one for me. Yeah, that's true. So somehow that virus spread from the civet to humans. Only one case was recorded in Australia, in New South Wales, and that kind of died down a bit. So we haven't heard of that particular SARS virus for a while. There was another one called MERS, M-E-R-S, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. It originated in the Middle East in 2012. Now, I don't know if I'd heard of this one before.
Yeah, I don't think I heard about that one either. Yeah.
No, it didn't actually spread around too much. It infected about 2,500 people worldwide, and it came from contact with dromedary camels. They're not sure exactly how it spread. Was the camel eaten, or was it from their milk, or just general contact with camels? And this one wasn't too easily spread from human to human, and no cases recorded in Australia with that one. Now, COVID-19, so we all know it originated from the Wuhan province in China. As of now, or as of a couple of days ago, it's infected about 97,000 people that we know of, if that's the actual information that we've been given, is, because we're not sure, how forthcoming China actually have been with the number of cases. So it's kind of, it's a rough estimation. Anyway, in any case, so far it's much more than the other two viruses.
Yes, yeah.
It's claimed about 3,300 people claim their lives. So it's quite contagious. Now, compared with the normal flu, 0.1% of people could die from the common flu, but about 2% of people can die from coronavirus. So it's quite virulent. The symptoms for coronavirus are fever, dry cough, fatigue, shortness of breath, and it can lead to pneumonia and multi-organ failure. And the symptoms are the same in SARS and MERS, but they tend to have a gastrointestinal component as well, such as diarrhea and vomiting. So far, it hasn't shown up in the current coronavirus. So coronavirus, these kinds of coronaviruses are actually called beta coronaviruses, and it's thought that they originate from bats, or the MERS, it was from the camels. So a coronavirus under the microscope, when they look under an electron microscope, it has a crown-like appearance. It's spherical. It's about 120 to 160 nanometers in diameter, so it's really, really tiny. It has an outer envelope with 20 nanometer long club-shaped projections, which are like little spikes that stick out. They're little proteins that help attach to your host cell.
So can I interrupt? Is that what those images of that, there's coronavirus and there's this ball-like thing with little spiky things, that's kind of an image from that, is it?
Yeah. So, under the microscope, it kind of resembles a crown or like the corona of the sun.
Right.
I got to mention the sun anyway in this episode.
Right. Yeah. Got some space science in there, yeah.
Got some, just a tiny bit. And it has the appearance, you know, it's like a spiky ball. Like I think when people say germs and viruses, they often show like that spiky virus, you know. So
or
it's a typical
underwater mine, perhaps.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah,
yeah, that's very good. Yeah. You know, and there have been other types of so these viruses are thought to originate in animals and spread to humans. Now there are other types of viruses that we have heard of that have come from animals. So this is not the first one. We've heard of swine flu, AIDS has come from animals, bird flu, Ebola, and the list goes on. There is the way that the coronavirus or this kind of virus infects you. So what it does, so the spiky balls, the little spikes on the cell of the virus itself, they lock in, so they will go to a specific cell and they'll fit just right into its target cell, okay? And so what it does, it fuses then with the cell, so that virus will fuse with the host cell and all its contents empty inside into the host cell. Inside the virus itself, its genetic material is an RNA, so they've got DNA and RNA. And its RNA is replicated in the cytoplasm of the host cell. So the cytoplasm is just that liquid inside the cell. And inside the cell, you've also got little organelles, they're called, just like little machinery inside the cell. And it will actually use that machinery to create more viruses. So the viruses are then transported out of the cell and into the body. And this causes the destruction of the cell. So it can be spread through coughing, sneezing. The spray can go up to about 6 feet in the air, so when you sneeze. So they're not sure if you actually catch it just through particles in the air or by touching surfaces. The particles will land on the surfaces. So they're just treating it as if you can catch it both ways at the moment. So there are three phases to this infection. Okay, so you've got the viral replication, immune hyperactivity, and pulmonary destruction, which are all scary.
I don't like the third one at all.
No. So I'll just roughly go through how the infection progresses in the body. So now this COVID-19 or the SARS-CoV-2 virus has an affinity for lung cells. So it's going to go straight for your respiratory system.
Mm.
There are two types of lung cells that it infects and kills. So you've got your goblet cells, they're called, and they're the ones that produce mucus in your lungs and it keeps the lungs moist. And also you've got ciliated cells, which have little hairs on the outside of the cells, and that helps to sweep up the mucus. And in your mucus, you could have things like pollen, bacteria, dust, you know, all sorts of foreign bodies that land into your lungs, basically. And so what it does, normally these cells will just whip up the mucus straight up to your throat. And, you know, usually you don't notice, but a lot of the day you're swallowing. So it'll go down into your stomach and basically get destroyed. So if you have any other, you know, kind of viruses or bacteria or anything that's going to cause you harm in your body, it'll just go straight down your stomach, get obliterated, and you're fine. These cells with this virus are basically killed off. And what happens, it causes a bit like a pneumonia type illness. So there's a lot of clogging up of the lungs with all the mucus and the cells that have died. So you start to get a pneumonia happening. Your lungs start to fill up with all the mucus and liquid and stuff. And then after this phase, what happens is that the immune response kicks in. It can cause an immune hyperactivity. Now, not all of this happens in everyone, but it does tend to happen in people who are more at risk of getting very ill from this virus. So you may be infected and just have a little bit of a cold, or you can be infected and some people are infected, they don't feel it. Some people are infected and they don't survive. So this is probably from the next point onwards. So the immune response starts up. The body recognizes it's under attack, sends out its immune cells to fight the virus and to repair tissue. This response can go haywire and starts to actually damage healthy tissue as well. So now you've got an inflammation of the lungs. Mm. So not only have you got a bit of a pneumonia, but you've got an inflammation of the lungs. The third phase, the lung damage continues, the pneumonia continues. You can start to get respiratory failure. If you're unlucky to get that far, you could be on a ventilator to help you breathe. And then as part of this response, you get a release of something, proteins called cytokines, and they're just released by your normal immune cells, such as T cells, T lymphocytes. There's a whole range of different cells that do different things in an immune response. But this can go overboard. So they're supposed to kind of signal where an infection is and regulate the infection, but then they just go overboard and then they start attacking healthy cells as well. And you start getting an inflammation, weakening of the blood vessels. The fluid enters into the alveoli, which are the little air sacs that help you to breathe. The cells where the blood passes through and the oxygen passes through, and that helps you to get oxygen into your blood normally. If this gets even more and more out of control, it can pass down to your lungs, your liver and your kidneys, and it can actually start to cause organ shutdown.
Right, yeah.
And if you get that far, unfortunately, I don't think there's much that can help. If you survive and come out of it, you are not unscathed, unfortunately. You could end up with lung damage because the virus, they've shown, can punch holes in the lungs, and you end up with a bit of a honeycomb appearance, which leads to scarring. And they're not sure if this is permanent or if it's reversible. So I'm not trying to sound, you know, down, but I'm trying to just, you know, I just wanted to outline how the virus does actually work in the body, because I wasn't really sure why, you know, I wasn't sure if the hype is all worth it. You know, is coronavirus something we really need to worry about, or is it just another flu? I don't think it's just another flu. I think we do need to take precautions and not catch it. I mean, there have been cases of people dying from it. I guess it's not heaps of people dying from it, but if you're particularly vulnerable, then I'd really not want to catch this disease. I mean, who wants a flu-like thing anyway? Yeah, definitely washing hands, good thing. Trying to keep minimal contact if you know somebody's had the coronavirus or has been in contact with somebody who has been. And, yeah, I mean, this kind of hygiene is important for any flu season or any, you know, cold and flus anyway, or even gastros and things like that. So
right, yeah.
Good old washing your hands at all times, you know, bathroom, you know, food, when you've been to places outdoors, shopping centres, whatever, not to be overboard, but just to have a healthy consideration that it could be floating around somewhere. I mean, the control of people moving around in Australia has been quite good, being kept to a minimum, but we are getting outbreaks. Even today I've heard of other outbreaks happening. I think we have a hospital in Queensland now where people
unfortunately, quarantine.
A school in New South Wales, I think, has been closed on Friday.
Yes, for a couple of days, though, not for the whole 2 weeks. Yeah, there was one student who came back from overseas, I think, or he got it from a parent, and turned out he had it, so they closed the school while they assess what's happening there, yeah.
That's it. We've had people on the Diamond Princess cruise.
Yes, yeah.
One man passed away in, I think it was Western Australia, so it's just, yeah, it's just good to keep in mind. I mean, I'm not panicking. Maybe I bought a few extra rolls of toilet paper just like everyone
we'll talk about that in a minute, yeah.
Anyway, that gives you an overview of what it does.
Yeah, thanks. I feel like Jared and I should have been sitting there taking notes from Caroline's University just then. Yeah, the Caroline University of Virology or something. Yeah. On the news this morning, I was reading one of our, I forgot which news site it was, but one of them was reporting that there's an app that you can have on your PC while you're working, and it will use your camera to warn you when you're about to touch your face and say, no, don't do it, like a warning will pop up and say that. Yeah.
I
forgot what it's called, but yeah, maybe I'll find out and put it in the show notes, because that was as silly as that sounds, it's actually probably really helpful in reducing people's risk of touching a surface and then touching their face by accident too. So
yeah, absolutely. And I just scratched my nose. Yeah.
Yeah. There we go. Yeah. What is it? So can we just change the direction of our discussion a little bit to the shopping thing that's going on? And Jared, I might throw it over to you first of all. Have you been to the shops lately and seen empty shelves, or have you been aware of some of the emptying that's been going on?
Certainly been aware of it, and I'm going to get it first-hand experience. Once we finish podcasting, I'm slated to go out to do the weekly shop.
Right.
So I'm a little nervous what I might find.
Yeah.
Or not find.
Yeah, well, that's more likely. I went to Aldi this morning just after Damien's swimming and Alexander's swimming. And we just need to get, you know, some milk and bread and some basics and whatever. But yeah, the whole toilet roll, you know, like half the aisle, like there was no toilet paper whatsoever. So I actually quickly messaged Dom on our Slack channel just before we started this conversation to say, well, what's it like in the United States? You know, what kind of, you know, precautions are people taking there? And he said, yeah, there are some stores that are running out of, you know, soaps and antibacterial lotions and things. People have been told to stock up in case of a 2 week self quarantine that might be put on people. And he said people are stocking up on snacks like potato chips as well. And Carol, I think you did mention about storing some popcorn away in case you got trapped at home at one point.
I did buy popcorn. Yeah. I bought some baked beans. I bought.
But we've had this phenomenon that has been on the news. It's been probably the number one news story almost this week, hasn't it? Where for some reason, people in Australia have been going crazy about toilet paper and buying it wherever they can.
Yeah, it seems to be the item that everybody's desperate for. I mean, I only bought a couple of rolls because I thought I don't want to run out in case. Yeah. But then I guess everybody else in Australia's had the same thought and sort of bought up everything.
It just kind of caught on, didn't it? I was really shocked. Yeah. I mean, I know that, you know, pasta, there's less pasta on the shelves. I even saw it myself this morning. You know, pasta sauce, but there is still supplies on the shelves you can get if you want. even though it's emptying out. I saw
no tissues at my Woolworth. Zero tissues.
Well, I mean, when the toilet paper runs out, tissues are next. So, you know, I also saw that long life milk, like UHT milk, is there's less of it on the shelves.
Yeah, I bought some of that.
Yeah. Well, we bought some as well, just in case. But we didn't buy tons of it. You know, we bought a couple of bottles.
No, just a few.
And I wanted to highlight just quickly that Food Bank Australia. Now, these are people who store up food for vulnerable people in Australia. They do food runs for elderly and sick and whatever else. They were just reminding people on Facebook yesterday, please to be careful. And I actually posted it on my reposted it. All right, amen to this. You know, because they were saying, you know, when you're shopping, ask yourself, do you really need 3 months to 6 months worth of food and toilet paper and things like this? And they talked about how there are vulnerable people who, like elderly, for example, who it's very hard for them to get to the shops in some cases, but they go anyway. And then when they get there, what they need isn't there. And I've got a true story of this just from a couple of days ago. So my next door neighbor, she's quite elderly, you know, and she lost her husband a year ago now. So she's on her own and she comes to our house every now and then and she'll give us things or she'll ask us for things, which we're very happy to help her. And I embarrassingly had to ask her, I said, now, do you have enough toilet rolls at home? And she goes, oh, yeah, I think I have about three, you know, but I had to ask her and I said, look, we haven't got tons here, but we've got enough, I think. But I said to her, if you need any more, just come and see us and, you know, please don't hesitate to ask. But it sounds so silly that this poor woman, you know, if it was a 2 week thing that, you know, or anyone else who's in her position where the most basic item of toilet paper is gone because, and I did see footage on ABC News, for example, of people with piles high of trolleys, like just full of packets of toilet paper. So people storing up and keeping for themselves. Yeah. And I don't want to call it selfish behavior, but it is dangerous behavior because it leaves some people, you know, it leaves people out who need it the most. It's like people who are more able to go and do it can get it before anyone else can get it as well.
Well, maybe if you want to buy one extra for you, then maybe buy one for a food bank or someone as well and maybe go donate it or go and give it to someone down the street who you think can't go out themselves and maybe give them something as well.
Yeah, I won't criticize people for buying, but what I would suggest is if you are buying, think about maybe the people around you, like you said, Caroline, who are vulnerable and maybe just buy some for them too. If you've got some elderly people on your street or something, or if you know a family who struggle to buy things anyway, maybe just put a few in storage for them to help them out too. Yeah. Jerry, anything on panic buying or coronavirus that you wanted to share?
Yeah, well, on the panic buying, one of the thoughts is that whether people would try and resell them at a, you know, price gouging sort of price. So I've gone and had a hunt around to see what I could find. eBay didn't have many hits worth noting, but a couple on Gumtree here. So I've got one roll of two-ply toilet paper,
$3,999.
Oh my goodness,
okay.
Sold.
That's extreme. I'll take it.
Yeah. Independently packaged, convertible to hanging over or under, rare pattern print, one owner, never used.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, I'm glad they specified that.
I was going to say another one here. This is in New South Wales, so outside, a bit far away for us to get this one. It's a rare collectible toilet roll, regretful sale, best offer.
Oh,
so they call it a rare farm outhouse find, rare as hen's teeth, back up for sale due to his previous client falling through. thought the postage was a bit much, opted out, offered to throw in a can of Glen 20 and scented gum leaves, but deep regret due to global limitation, she's not taking it. And he goes on and on and on and said, no hail, flood or bushfire damage due to the harsh Queensland sun, the glue's starting to come away. No tie kickers, no low ballers, will not swap for children or goats.
Oh my goodness.
It does say funds to charity if you did end up taking them up on this offer.
Well, there's at least a silver lining to it there, yeah. And I've got to say, for people who might sound shocked by that, this is the Aussie larrikin coming out. You just look up larrikinism, and this is exactly what Australians do, you know, generally speaking, in a crisis, is they tend to make a lot of light of it. And I think it's kind of a bit of a coping mechanism, isn't it? Like how we survive, we just...
Making light of the fact that people are losing their minds and buying up toilet paper pack after toilet paper pack when you know, a pack of 12 would probably last you a week pretty comfortably, or a family a week pretty comfortably.
Depends how many pieces of paper Harry flushes down the toilet each session.
It reminds me of that, I think it was Animaniacs cartoon where the duck flush things down the toilet. You first get the toilet paper and the train and all these toys.
I just love when they put a bit in and it's still attached to the roll and they flush it.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, that's, disaster in the making. All right. All right. I don't know how this became toilet humor, so let's move on. And look, the serious message in this, like I said, is think about everyone else when you're shopping. You know, make sure and think about the people who are around you and your community. And if you can share, it's a good idea to do that as well. All right. Thanks for that, Caroline. Why don't we move on now to something personal?
I bet you don't know anything about me.
You were born in Phoenix. You went to school in Tempe. You're an only child. Your favorite show is something called The Real Housewives of Atlanta. And your favorite book is Kendall Jenner's Instagram feed.
How did you know all that?
So I wanted to share a story. Just about a recent thing that happened in my family. And it has to do with Lent, and it has to do with us starting Lent a little bit later than everyone else. So what happened was a couple of weeks ago, so it was the Tuesday night / Wednesday morning. No, let me get that right. It was Monday night / Tuesday morning before Ash Wednesday. And our two-year-old, Alexander, he started coughing like it was a croup-like cough. For anyone who doesn't know what croup is, it sounds like a barking cough. It's really strong. It's really bad to hear. And kids start to struggle to breathe with this cough. And Alexander had it before once last year. And Isabel and I, that first time he had it, we were thinking, should we take him to the hospital? Do we watch him? In the end, we thought, we called Nurse on Call and they said, yeah, hospital is probably better. And we took him to the emergency room. So this time round, we heard the cough and we thought, let's not hesitate. Let's go. So we had to wake up poor Damien, who was already asleep. And this was about, I think it was about 11:30 at night. And we took Alexander to the emergency room. And he started sounding a bit better by the time we got to the hospital. So when he had a bit of a wheeze in his chest, but not the coughing anymore. So when the first nurse initially checked him, she didn't seem too concerned. And I think we got put last on the list because we were the last people seen that were there. And it was about 5 o'clock in the morning. So we'd been there all night with no sleep, which was not fun. So when they saw him, the doctor looked at him and said, look, I can hear some wheezing. He doesn't sound too bad. I'll give you a prescription for prednisolone, which is a steroid that kind of opens up the breathing a bit. And he said, if he sounds worse, just go buy some in the morning and take him. So we went home with that and I called work. So I can call work any time of the night and leave a voice message if I'm not going to be around at work or something. So I called work and I said, so it's 5:30 in the morning and I'm just going to bed now after everything that's happened. So I'll be coming in at 10 o'clock. So I just get I thought to myself, I'll get 3 hours of sleep and then go into school. So I did that. And so during that 3 hours that we tried to sleep, Alexander kept waking up crying and being upset, you know, frequently. So I said to Isabel, maybe you take him to the doctor, you know, I'll go to work and you take him to the doctor. But then the crying was getting worse by the time I was about to go to work. So I called work and said, I'm not coming in. I thought I'd help Isabel take him to the doctor. So I did that. The doctor took one look at him and I told him the whole story about the emergency room, whatever. And he said they should have admitted him. So Alexander was breathing like, like his tummy was going right in. You could see his ribs, you know, it's that kind of thing. So the doctor said, give him a bigger dose of prednisolone than normal. So you can give a double dose. So it wasn't quite a double dose, but it was a larger one. He said, so give him this dose, take him home and bring him back at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and we'll see what happens. So we did all that, gave him the dose, took him home. And basically I sat on the couch all day. This was on Tuesday now. With Alex, he didn't want to leave me. Like, he didn't want me to leave his side. So he slept on me. He'd wake up between every half an hour to an hour crying. He'd have a little sip of water. He wouldn't eat anything and he'd go back to sleep again. And that was our whole day until 4 o'clock. So then 4 o'clock, I went to the doctor and he said, he doesn't look better. He actually looks a little bit worse. So you need to take him to the hospital. So this time he wrote a letter for us, and he wrote urgent in big letters in his handwriting on it. We went to the emergency room, and within 5 minutes, Alexander was admitted. So he was in hospital for that Tuesday. Now, when they were in the initial admissions before he was put into a ward, we had this this African doctor. He was awesome, this great guy. He actually gave Alexander his phone and got him to watch The Lion King while he looked at him and treated him, whatever. And so he said, now I'll be back in a moment, and I'll just see what's going to happen next. So he walked off and he closed the curtain. And then 10 seconds later, he comes back and opens the curtain. He says, oh, by the way, you should probably know you're going to be staying here overnight. And then he closed the curtain and walked away again. So I knew straight away that it was getting a bit serious. Now, so he was admitted. They gave him different, there are two different types of Ventolin puffers that he had. And so he started to improve, but they wanted to keep watching him because his breathing wasn't awesome. So they wanted to keep observing him overnight. So then they said only one parent can stay. So Isabel and I talked about it, and she thought maybe it's better if I stayed because Alexander had been attached to me. He kept wanting me. So I ended up sleeping cramped in a hospital bed with him. And so he gradually improved, which is good. So overnight he got better and better. The nurses were waking us up every hour or so to check him, treat him, and see how he's going. And they were saying, yeah, he's doing better, which was good. And we were in hospital till I think Alexander was discharged at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and Isabel and I were wiped out. So we're both exhausted. You know, she missed a night and a half of sleep, and I missed practically, it felt like two nights of sleep. And so I said to her, you know, it's Ash Wednesday, Lent has started. And I said to her, it's really the last thing on my mind right now. And I felt bad saying that, but that's where it was. That's where we were both at. Damien had gone to school and he'd received Ashes, so his Lent started and whatever. And I said to Isabel, why don't we just wait and start our Lent a couple of days later? And, you know, canon law doesn't cover this. It's not necessarily the right thing to do, but we just weren't in any position to start sacrificing things, to start giving things up, because we'd given up so much already. You know, we were, like I said, we were exhausted and flat out, and we'd been worried and gone through the whole process. So I said to Isabel, let's start on Saturday. So I said, we'll have Ash Saturday. That's what we decided to do. So what we did was, my school, we do our Ash Wednesday services at school. And so, I'd actually been part of the group that had organized our Ash Wednesday services, and I heard it went really well, and I was sad to miss it, but that was where we were. But we have blessed ashes at school. So, I took a bowl of blessed ashes home. And then we had dinner on Saturday night, and then we had a little Ash Wednesday service at home. So obviously we weren't being priests or anything, so like, don't worry, everyone, it's all good. But what we did was, I had the gospel for the day, and some reflections on Ash Wednesday and Lent. And we sat around the table, we put a crucifix and a purple candle on our dinner table. And we sat around together as a family. And while Alexander was spitting and laughing and being happy because he was better now, we all took a turn in reading and sharing some prayers of the faithful. And then we got Damien to give us the ashes and put them on our forehead. So we started Lent with Ash Saturday. So now we're back on track and everything's fine. But I guess my reflection was, and this podcast will come out a little over the halfway mark, I think it is, during Lent. And for all of us in Lent and even during Advent, sometimes we have false starts or we don't have starts because things happen to us. And I was thinking, you know, had this situation gone on for longer, when would we have started Lent? When we would have actually been able to prepare ourselves for Easter? And I think my reflection is, it's not too late to start. Now, we started 3 or 4 days after, which was fine. But if you're listening to this podcast and you feel like you haven't really started, like, you know, you've gone through the motions, you've received your ashes, you're sacrificing things and whatever, but in your heart, you feel like you're not really there, it's not too late to start. And it's not too late to take a few steps back and think, well, why am I doing this? And the simple answer, really, why are you doing this? You're just making room for Jesus. That's all you're doing. So don't think too much about, you know, overcomplicating it and all the big deals, and think about all the things that you've given up or haven't given up. Really, what it is that we choose to put one thing aside and say, Jesus, take the place of this thing in my life. And it's as simple as that. And I think we did the right thing, and please tell me if you think we didn't, but I think we did the right thing in waiting until our hearts were prepared to start Lent rather than just trying a false start, which I think that Ash Wednesday would have been. So that's the reflection I wanted to share there. Now, Caroline, actually, Jared and Caroline, before we go on to your other news, Caroline, do you guys have any reflections about how Lent has started for you or anything in your family's Ash Wednesday Lent-wise that you wanted to share?
I think I wanted to, just listening to you, I wanted to tell you that even if you'd think you didn't start Lent on Ash Wednesday, you did. because you did go through the sacrificing and the suffering, and maybe it was kind of the right day to do it, if you think, because it's Ash Wednesday. And so it was the beginning of Lent. And I mean, I hate to hear that my nephew was suffering so much. And, you know, we were all with you in spirit, and, you know, it was a hard time. And in a way, we were suffering with you, because it's such a horrible thing to hear that, you know, that Alex was suffering so much with his breathing, and we weren't sure what it was. I mean, the word coronavirus came into my mind, but I didn't want to say anything, you know. I just didn't know what he was suffering from. So I mean, thank God he's fine now, and, you know, he's cheeky as ever.
So what you're saying is Alexander has impeccable timing.
Yes, exactly. So he started it for you, whether you liked it or not. And yeah. I really love that you had a little ceremony, and that Damien, you know, gave you and Isabel the ashes. So that's really lovely. Yeah.
Yeah, we need some way to start it. Yeah. Jerry, did you have any reflections of your own about Lent and Ash Wednesday?
Nothing so in depth and deep as yours. Clearly, because ours sort of started off without a hitch, really. But, I suppose listening to your reflection as well, yeah, it's not the physical timing of it, or the branding, if you like, of being branded with ashes. It's the walking and the journey to what we're approaching, which is the death and the resurrection of Jesus is the end goal. And so the fact that you will walk three less days, you have a 37-day Lent, if you like, doesn't necessarily diminish that as compared to if you'd done a 40-day, but you'd run it a little harder and it not work so well.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And, Jared, just for our audience's sake, have you been on the peri-peri sauce at all, or have you managed to hang on?
No, I've kept well away. One thing that hasn't gone so well with the standard giving up chocolate, because that's just it's almost a standard thing
for us. It's a given, yeah.
Didn't check the cupboards before, you know, on Fat Tuesday or anything like that, or Shrove Tuesday. And so when I've gone to have a look in the cupboards, oh, there's a chocolate bar there, and there's chocolate covered muesli bars there, and in the fridge, what's there to snack on? Oh, there's chocolate bars here. Where are the non-chocolate snacks?
Yes. Yeah. Why does that happen?
So they're going to be sitting there for the next 6-odd weeks, unless the kids get into them, I guess.
Yeah.
Because they're too young to be observing anything, any nonsense like giving up chocolate.
Yeah, you should call it your Easter bonus and just save it up. Yeah. Yeah, thanks for that. And Caroline, so you just wanted to share a little bit of news as well about a sad thing that happened in your family's life recently.
Yeah. It was a very sad thing. Everyone knows I'm a cat lover. And one of my cats, Sylvester, he was 18 and a half years old, and he started being ill, but he really started going downhill from about the beginning of this year. He was losing weight, and he was sort of kind of getting a bit of cat dementia as well, not kind of knowing where he was, and getting obsessed with things like forgetting he'd eaten and forgetting he had a drink, and, you know, kept following me around the house. And, you know, so I had to keep humoring him, you know, okay, he's more water, he's more food. And then he was getting sick in a few other ways, you know, that I won't mention, but I had to really look after him. And I took him to the vet, and, you know, she basically told me he had a tumor. She was thinking it was in his stomach. And he seemed okay. He seemed to be holding on. And, you know, I thought maybe, you know, he's got a few more months, you know, maybe another 6 months or so. But unfortunately, this past Monday, he seemed to be fine, but he was very kind of wobbly when he was walking. And I could tell he was losing energy, you know, kind of, you know, he's having trouble, you know, just doing normal things. And then on the Tuesday I went to work and Phil was home, working from home that day, and he told me he didn't get up all day. He was kind of just, he sat down, but he kind of was lying on his side. And I know Sylvester doesn't like to lie on his side, really. And he started having trouble moving, and he basically kind of just gave up, you know. And so he went downhill really quickly, practically overnight. And I think I was texting you guys, you know, we have our family chat.
That's right. Yeah.
And I wanted to keep you all in the loop because I know you all loved Sylvester too. Yeah. I've had him for such a long time. He's kind of part of the family. And Tuesday he wasn't moving. And then I kept him in my room on Tuesday night, and I thought, I just put him down next to me on the blanket on the floor, and I thought, you know what, he's probably not going to make the night. But this guy is really, he's a stubborn cat, and he didn't pass away. Not that I wanted him to, but, you know, but then I could see he was really suffering. His breathing was labored, and he wasn't conscious anymore. So basically I had to make the call, and I didn't want him to suffer anymore. So I took him to the vet that morning, and so this past Wednesday was March the 4th. My poor boy Sylvester passed away, and I'm finding it really hard to get over him.
Yeah,
because,
of course.
You know, he's been my cat partner in crime. You know, it's like if you ever have such a bond with anyone who's had a dog or a cat who they've had for a long time, they've basically done everything with them. You know, Sylvester's moved houses with me. I mean, I had my cat before I met my husband, before I had my children, before I did anything, you know, before I started getting into a full-time job and all the rest of it. So, yeah, he's really been everywhere with me and done everything with me. So I'm finding his loss really difficult. The vet was such a hard time for anyone's had to go through.
Yeah.
Having to, just let your pet go like that. You know how devastating it is. So that's a really hard one for me. I mean, that's a good suffering for me to offer up during this Lent. But, I mean, it brought up questions. The boys were obviously upset, and then they were asking me about, is Sylvester in heaven? Is he with Jesus? Is he with, you know?
Yeah.
Auntie Josie, who passed away last year, you know, is he happy now? And, you know, so I was just, I don't know whether animals go to heaven or not, but I was just saying, yes, Sylvester's in heaven and we'll see him when we go to heaven. And then we, for closure for all of us, we actually had a little funeral service. So,
yeah, nice.
We dug a hole in the little new garden that I'm making in the backyard because we've got a new house. And, I've had to start the garden from scratch. So now I've got the Sylvester Memorial Garden.
Nice.
And we before we buried him, we all held hands, me, Harry, Frankie and Phil, and we prayed and we said, you know, we prayed, said, thank you, God, for Sylvester and all the nice times and the memories that we had with him. And then we took him out and we buried him and put flowers over him, so we cried our hearts out.
Yeah, of course.
And to see your little baby, your little fur baby like that is so heartbreaking. But I've got his collar, so I'm going to hang it somewhere in the house. So.
Yeah, oh, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Thanks for sharing that. And I think, you know, I didn't know that part of the story, but knowing that we have rituals for our families centered around prayer when something happens, I think is a really important thing. So, yeah, so thanks for sharing that. So let's, we're getting into overtime territory, or massively overtime territory, because we had quite a few things to talk about and share today. So we might wrap it up there. So we just wanted to thank everyone for joining us for this episode 28 of The Catholics of Oz. And before we'd like to go, we'd like to thank so much the patrons of SQPN who make it possible for us to share The Catholics of Oz and all the other shows that are on the network. So today we want to especially thank Eric A, Nancy C, Sher W, and Daniel C. Because of them and because of others who give at sqpn.com/give, They make it possible for the Catholics of Oz and all of the other shows at StarQuest to continue. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. And a big thank you to all of you who do that. Also, we'd like to know your thoughts about today's episode. So we talked about quite a few things. So if there's anything that you'd like to share in relation to that or anything you can relate to, you can leave us feedback by visiting sqpn.com/oz, spelt O-Z, and you can see our show notes there as well. You can also find a post about this episode at SQPN's Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. But also, don't forget, we have our own Catholics of Oz Facebook page at facebook.com/Catholics of Oz. You can join us in discussing our latest episodes there. You can also reach us by email at catholicsofoz@sqpn.com. Caroline, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you. It's fun as always.
And Jerry, thank you as well for being on the show.
Yep, pleasure to have been here.
And once again, I'm Lindsay Sant, and thank you for listening to episode 28 of The Catholics of Oz on StarQuest.